You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Chris Lopez here. For those who don't know me, I'm a real estate agent at YourCast Real Estate, and I focus on helping investors build a rental portfolio. And so this episode is going to continue, actually be the second in a three-part series on structuring business entities, mostly geared around holding rental properties, since, hey, great, I help people to buy the rental properties and plan out their investments at their long-term retirement goals. I know protecting them is vitally important, but I am not the expert when it comes to it. But I know one of the experts around town. I'm very glad to have Peter McFarland back with me. Peter, how are you?
I'm great, Chris. How about you?
I'm doing really good. So to bring him up to speed, this is the second of a three-part series. If you have not watched the first episode, I would definitely recommend checking that out first, because the way Peter structured these are to like build upon the previous one. So it's almost like a mini course curriculum where the second episode builds upon the first one, and the third one builds upon this one. So if you haven't checked that out, make sure you do, because it gives you the foundation for what you need to know about business entities. And we went over some very basic structures on what you can do as a real estate professional and also as a real estate property owner. So Peter, what are we talking about today?
Yeah, we're taking business entities kind of one step further, right? It just exactly like you said last week, and with business entities 101, really we were just laying the groundwork, right? Some very general, broad concepts and rules, whatever, about using business entities and what they are and best practices. So today we're doing a deeper dive, looking more at business entities and really business entities focused more on just rental properties, right? And how we approach rentals and larger portfolios with rentals, those kind of things, as well as I'm going to dive in to a lot about actually choice of entity. And so why you might choose, say, a LLC over a partnership, or a why you might integrate a trust or not integrate a trust or something like that. So it's more exciting for me today at any rate, because we're talking about some maybe more specific and higher level issues rather than just like the very ground floor, right? Which is mostly what I wind up talking about when I go places and talk about business entities. So this is really cool.
Good. Well, I'm looking forward to diving in, because I always learn quite a few things.
I'm glad. Yeah. So this is me, right? Peter McFarland. I like to get up on my soapbox and talk a little bit about me. And for those of you who are listening and no visuals, it's just a picture of me, right? But basically, I'm a partner at Long Law Group. I'm a senior business advisor with Business Innovation Group. Those two companies are sister companies. And depending on the service you're looking for, you're going to partner with one of those two companies if you wind up working with us. But if I put up a slide about me and kind of talk about me and all of my laurels and whatever, that really is only like 1/8 of the picture or the puzzle, right? Because really with Business Innovation Group, it's funny with the law firm, we're so tied into like, who are the attorneys and are they a partner and who, who's putting in the billable time and whose expertise am I kind of getting? That's really a symptom of working with a law firm and the legal profession in general. With Business Innovation Group, instead, what we're trying to do is leverage our entire team, right? And kind of look at what everybody brings to the table. And so every single person you see up on this slide here, and those who are listening, it's a slide of my entire team for the most part. There's two people missing, but everybody here is a professional, right? And so what we're looking to do is leverage the expertise of everybody, because not everybody knows everything, right? And some people are better with numbers. Other people are better at advocating. Right before the webinar, actually, Chris and I were talking about the difference between a CPA and an attorney and who you might want representing you, say, in tax court, right? And what the advantage or disadvantages are. So, everybody's just wired differently. And this is, there's strength in the team, so to speak. But with Business Innovation Group, we do business advisory and planning, revenue and profit improvement. We can do cash flow analysis and actually forecast out and look at the future and what that looks like. We can do tax planning and preparation, bookkeeping, business entities, executive development. We can also help with real estate strategy and planning. So a lot of kind of value added over and above what a normal CPA or bookkeeping firm might do. So with that, I'm going to give a little bit of an opening perspective. And if you were with us on the prior webinar about business entities, this is going to be a little bit of a review, but I wanted to kind of remind everybody of some of the real basics, as well as for our first-time listeners, at least give a little bit of a context of what I'm going to be talking about today. So this slide should look very familiar to anybody who's kind of gone through the analysis of what entities for real estate would look like, and particularly anybody who's on the call last week. But here, what we really want to set up for rentals is a master LLC. That master LLC is owned by two partners at least. So we want it to be a multi-member LLC. We're going to have that company file a tax return. And then below that, we're going to have sub-LLCs. And those sub-LLCs are 100% owned by that master LLC. If you're listening, it just basically forms an upside, or sorry, not an upside down, a regular pyramid. And that master LLC is kind of at the top, and it owns the sub-LLCs 100% underneath.
And then the actual persons, so for example, me and my wife, we would be... You draw the line above the master LLC because we're the people that own that master LLC, right?
Correct. Yeah. And then you could even draw lines below the sub LLCs to the properties that they own, right? Because I want the sub LLCs to actually hold title to the properties. And then the master LLC indirectly owns the properties through the sub LLCs, if that makes sense.
So I feel like you need a giant whiteboard at your office.
Yeah.
Draw lines and circles. Is that the way you present it?
We have a giant whiteboard in the office. Yeah. But I actually don't use that. What I do instead is I have a notebook in front of me and I literally just scribble the entire time. And by the end of the meeting, you know, nobody can even recognize what I was drawing from the first point. But yeah, I mean, it's funny because it's such a visual, or it's easier to kind of envision it. And I'm such a visual person that it's easier just to draw it all out. Right. So for those of you listening rather than seeing, you might be at a slight disadvantage, but I'm going to do the best I can to describe what I have on the slides here. So anyways, this is really the structure for rentals, what it is that we really want to look at setting up and the best approach, in my opinion, here. Now, there's some value in structuring, right? And so for those who are listening, on this slide, on the left-hand side, I have that same structure we were talking about, that pyramid kind of structure. And then on the right-hand side, I've gone like totally overboard with a ton of extra entities and whatever. And the picture gets actually much more cloudy just because there's so many different entities on there, trusts and S corporations, family limited partnerships, and then the same structure that I've been talking about. So what I'm trying to kind of describe here or get at here is that I don't want people to think about like getting carried away, right? Asset protection is great. You should absolutely structure and structure well and structure to accomplish your goals. But at the same time, you can get carried away and you're going to spend more time running the structure, thinking about like, okay, what entity owns what? And if I'm signing my name, what's my title as I work my way through this structure? It's just going to be more headache than it's really worth, right? And so, you know, there are groups who like come into town, sell you on these giant packages. And then, you know, 3 years later, you wind up in my office and we start talking about how to dismantle it just because it's not worth the headache and hassle, right? So there's a value to what I'm talking about today, but like anything, you know, everything in moderation, right? Don't get carried away. All right. So let's talk a little bit about choice of entity, like why you would choose one particular entity over another. Full disclosure, I'm not going to talk about corporations this week. I'm going to do a small choice of entity section on the Entity 301 class, just because I think that it's better to talk about corporations when we're talking more about fixing and flipping or self-employment, rather than on the rental side. I never put rentals in a corporation, just as a rule. So,
and by corporations, you mean like C corps and S corps?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. So the way to think about that, Chris, is like on the state level, a corporation is a corporation is a corporation, right? No matter what, you're going to file articles of incorporation with the Secretary of State. You're going to have your bylaws, you know, whatever. The actual like structure for state purposes are identical, but then the difference between C and S is just the way that you're taxed and the way that the IRS is going to treat you.
Okay.
Yeah. So. So we can talk more about that kind of next week. But at the same time, today I'm not going to go through like the advantages and disadvantages of a corporation over anything else, because I think that's a discussion almost better saved for the next one. But everything else I'm going to talk about today, right? So, you know, one option when you're looking at going out and holding an investment or getting into business or whatever it may be is to go with what's called a sole proprietorship, right? We also have limited partnerships or general partnerships. We have limited liability companies, and then you can throw trusts in there as well, right? And so today I'm going to talk about each of these different types of entities and why you're going to choose one over the other, or what maybe the advantages or disadvantages are. But hopefully, I think by the end of the discussion, what you're really going to find out is why everybody chooses LLCs and why LLCs are kind of the entity of choice. That's a little bit of a preview, right? But sole proprietorships, basically with this, you don't really incorporate or organize at all. It's just you out there as an individual and you're engaging in business, right? The advantages of doing that is simplicity. You basically aren't a business entity, a formal legal structure. And as a result, it's really just you. And for tax purposes, you're considered what's called a disregarded entity. And so everything is just going to flow back onto your personal tax return. You're not going to file a separate tax return at all. And really, come tax time, the IRS just ignores the fact that, you know, potentially there's any kind of like structure or anything out there. Really, everything just flows back. So the advantages here is simplicity, because, you know, first off, there's no like annual filing with the Secretary of State. You don't really have to have like a separate business bank account. You don't have to worry about, you know, a separate tax return, anything like that. But the trade-off for all of that simplicity is that you're really, there's no asset protection associated with this at all. Because it is you just out there doing business. If you get sued, whoever's suing you is just going to sue you, right? There's no liability veil. There's no layer there to try to break through. It's just you. So all of your personal assets are potentially open to make good on a judgment, right? The next disadvantage is you have a higher audit risk. These numbers are slightly old. You know, it'd be interesting to see what the new audit figures look like, particularly after tax change, but it's just too early to see what the audit numbers look like after the increased standard deduction and all of that. But at any rate, these numbers are pretty trustworthy here. If you're a sole proprietor, about one in every 20 sole proprietors are selected for audit. Compare that to just creating an entity, getting the activity off of your personal tax return. That's about one in every 250 individuals.
Why? I mean, obviously that's not a typo, but that really surprises me. Why? Do you know why? Or does it matter?
Well,
I'm just curious.
No, yeah, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, first off, the IRS can't audit every single return that comes through, right? And so what they do is they select projects. And so what they basically say is like, okay, reasonable compensation in an S corporation, we're going to look at that as a project. 5 years of losses in a Schedule C, we're going to look at that. Travel, meals, and entertainment, if you have a lot of deductions in travel, meals, and entertainment on a Schedule C, we're going to look at that, right? And so you become kind of like part of this subcategory of returns that they're going to start looking at. And I know Schedule Cs in particular, because there's the potential to generate really large deductions on things that may not even be a business. It might be more of a hobby or something like that. That's a really hot button issue. And the IRS is always looking at that. Yeah. And then finally, because it all flows through onto your personal tax return, it doesn't even flow through. It's just on your personal tax return. There's really no tax advantages associated with this. There's no ability to plan around self-employment tax, and your planning opportunities are really limited. So, again, sole proprietorships are all about simplicity, right? They're super simple. And for some people in the stage at where they're at in terms of launching their careers or their activities here, that simplicity is really great. That's what you want. But there are some pretty significant disadvantages to going forward this way. So, you know, you might consider organizing as a partnership, right? This is just an example of what a limited partnership looks like. And for those listening, what I have is a triangle. It's kind of split in half, and there's general partners and limited partners. And what I'm trying to say here is that general partners have management in the partnership, and so they can make all of the decisions about what's going to happen with the partnership and how it's going to move forward and, you know, what deals it's going to enter, who can sign checks, all that stuff, right? The general partners have the management capability, but the flip side of that is that they have unlimited liability for the obligations of the partnership. Right. The limited partners, on the other hand, they have no management in the company. They're purely limited. They're just passive investors. Right. And because they are so passive, they have limited liability. So here we're getting a little bit better than the the sole proprietorship, because we are talking about limited liability, right? The limited partners are protected. But what really stinks is the general partners, they're stuck with unlimited liability, right? So if the partnership is sued, the general partners really don't have any protection associated with the entity. Right. A general partnership, on the other hand, you can just get rid of the bottom half of this this triangle here, and you'd only have the general partners who have all of the management, but they also have unlimited liability. And so there we're just looking at unlimited liability for everybody involved. And at that point, you know, you're just as good, just as well off as if you had done a sole proprietorship.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So let's go on to limited liability companies. You know, here I've kind of recreated the same idea. I have a triangle here, and the only people that I have listed are managers and members. And that's because there are members in a limited liability company. And then if you want, you can name managers as somebody who's authorized to kind of take care of the day-to-day for the company. Here, you have the member or the manager having management ability in the company, just like in the partnership, but the manager and the member has limited liability, just like the limited partners in a partnership. So rather than splitting it out and having general and limited partners, here you have people who have management and also limited liability. Right. So that's really why limited liability companies are one of the most popular business entities, right? And really the business entity of choice. When somebody comes into my office, 9 times out of 10, I'll set up an LLC.
Yeah. I mean, that's for most of the stuff I've done and for people I talk to, LLC seems to be like the go-to choice.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And part of that, too, and this is a little bit of a review, is that the taxation of LLCs is super flexible, right? And so LLCs showed up roughly in 1992. The tax code was drafted in 1986, right? And so the 1986 had the pre-existing categories of how things are going to be taxed: disregarded entity, partnership, S corporation, or C corporation. Well, the LLC can actually be taxed as any one of those things. It can be a disregarded entity, a partnership, an S corp, or a C corp. Compare that, for instance, just to a corporation. It can only be an S corp or a C corporation. It doesn't have the option of being a partnership or a disregarded entity. So LLCs are kind of like the best of both worlds, right? You get the really good asset protection where you can have the management decisions and all of that and still have the limited liability. But then ultimately, you can still choose almost any way that you want to be taxed, right? So if you ever do just a really cool thought experiment, at least I think this is really cool, just drive down the road and just look at all of the business signs and just see like how many are corporations, how many are partnerships, and how many are LLCs. And, you know, you'll see that like 95% are LLCs.
Hmm.
Yeah, the only ones who are left really are like professionals. Doctors and dentists still set up like PCs, professional corporations, and then lawyers. Well,
they can't set LLCs, right? Or cannot?
Well, so I actually thought for a long time, the way that the Colorado statutes were drafted, that you couldn't have a PLLC, right? Because that'd be like a professional limited liability professional limited liability company. And for a long time, I didn't think we had what would be considered like an enabling statute that basically says, yes, you can go ahead and set one of these up. And I since have done a reverse course on that. I think I found some guidance. I can't remember if it was on the Secretary of State's website or where it was. But PLLCs, I think, are viable now in Colorado. But for a long time, there actually was some debate about whether that was allowed or not. Just for reference, I actually set up a PLLC for myself last year. I believe in it so much that I did it for myself. So, but, you know, that's really for like doctors, lawyers, accountants, dentists, right? Somebody who has a professional license.
And that'd be for their professional practice. So a dentist will have their dental practice in a professional company, but they can still have LLCs for the rental properties.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The PLLC I set up was for my partnership interest in the law firm. Yeah. Okay. So I always get asked about trusts, right? Trusts are one of the maybe most misunderstood or I guess maybe not misunderstood, but like most utilized, but in maybe not the best way thing that I may run across in my practice. It's kind of interesting, but a lot of people, what they want to do is they want to use a trust. And what they do is they create a revocable trust, and then they hold the title to the real estate in that trust. Part of the reason they may do that is because they think that it's going to give you asset protection. The other reason they may do it is if they're like a wholesaler or something like that, and they're just looking to offload the property to a subsequent buyer, right? And it's easy to assign the interest in the trust to whoever comes along next, right?
Because then they're basically selling the trust,
yeah,
and not the actual contract or property, but selling the trust that owns the contract, owns the property, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That said, if you run into somebody trying to do this, have an attorney look at it. I'll say every single trust agreement that I've ever looked at that's been part of one of those deals has been incorrect. And the reason is because the person selling hasn't had the legal assistance and they haven't actually filled out whatever form they got or whatever, you know, from a guru or whoever it may be, and they haven't filled it out correctly. So what you're really buying is a legal headache because, you know, then somebody has to come back and try to fix the trust and try to, you know, kind of sort through what actually should have happened there. Yeah. So at any rate, you know, the advantages to a trust, and really the only time I ever use a trust is number one, to keep some privacy or anonymity in the public record. There is some value to using a trust for that. And the reason is because the there's no like formal registration for a trust with the Secretary of State.
Okay.
Right. And so you could create a trust and then never in the public record would they ever find out like who the beneficiaries of that trust are. Right. And so it's and you can list the trust as the owner of the property, like in the clerk and recorder records, if you title the property in the trust and all of that. And so there is a layer of privacy where that might make sense. The other reason that I might set up a trust, and this to me is kind of self-explanatory, but it would be a case where you have some legitimate estate planning concerns, right? If you're maybe getting on in age and you have younger children, and for some reason, you know, you don't think those children should inherit anything before their age 45, 50, you know, whatever it may be, you can use a trust to lock up that interest, right, until the kids are older. Another reason might be if you have beneficiaries who have gambling or drug problems or something like that, you can lock it up. And then potentially those assets aren't going to be reachable by creditors if they run up a debt or something like that. So there may be legitimate estate planning concerns at play. And absolutely, we should use a trust in those cases. But one of the reasons that I say that trusts are so widely misunderstood is that a lot of people come to me and they think that a trust is going to give them asset protection. And I say, well, maybe, but I ask them a little bit more about the trust and maybe a little bit more about what it looks like. And we find out that actually there's not going to be any asset protection associated with it at all. And part of the reason is because most people create these trusts as what are called revocable trusts. A revocable trust is exactly what it sounds like. You can revoke it at any time. So if you set up the trust, title property in it, and then a year or two later, you decide, you know, you totally change your mind and you want to rip down that trust and dissolve it, you can still do that, right? It's freely revocable. Right. The flip side of that coin is that there's also irrevocable trusts. And those are exactly what they sound like, which is once it's done and once you've put the property in there, it's a done deal. Right. It's irrevocable. There's nothing you can do to get that to shut down and get the property back. Right. The only way to do that would be to go to a court and appeal to a judge and just basically say, you know, we need to change our approach here entirely. And then the judge has to agree with you. Right. So at any rate, most people create these as revocable trusts because they want that flexibility, right? They want to be able to revoke it, get the property back and whatever. But in a case where you have a revocable trust, there's really no asset protection with that. Because let's say I sue somebody who has a revocable trust and they say, well, hold on, you can't reach this property because it's in trust. The judge is going to look at them and say, this is a revocable trust. Just revoke the stupid thing, pay your creditor, and let's be done with this. Like, what's the problem,
okay,
right? Yeah, so it has to be that irrevocable trust. And so really, when you think about it and think, well, would I use an LLC or would I use a trust or how does that look like, right? An LLC is better because you can dissolve the LLC at any time, right? You're going to get the limited liability that goes along with it, but also you have the flexibility of dissolving it, getting the property back or whatever, right? It's just a better tool. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so So first off, there's that. And I mean, second off, you have three people in a trust. You have the person who creates it. Then you have the trustee, and the trustee is the person who makes all of the management decisions. And then you have the beneficiary, and that's the person who benefits from the trust, right? Well, where you are all three, so if you are the person who creates it, the person who makes the decision, and the only person who benefits from it, first off, you don't even have a trust. Colorado law is written so that in that case, the trust doesn't even exist. So you have to name like another beneficiary, right? Maybe your kids or a friend or a charity or whatever it may be. Or you can name somebody else as the trustee, the person who's in charge of managing the trust. But the problem there is that, you have to get your trustee on board with any kind of management decision you may have, right? So they're going to have to cut the check. They're going to have to do whatever. If you want to upgrade something, the trustee is going to have to agree with you that actually it makes sense to upgrade that, right? And cut the check for it. So once again, you're just kind of giving up control when you don't really need to, right? If you could just set up an LLC and be the member or the manager of the LLC, you're really in charge and you're still going to get that limited liability.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And then finally, there's really no tax planning associated with a trust because most of these are drafted as what they call grantor trusts, which are just like a disregarded entity where everything flows through to your personal tax return. And so because there's no separate dedicated tax return associated with the structure, there's really no tax planning that's going to go along with that. So, you know, again, just some disadvantages there. You can, once again, just kind of, you know, tie it back, use a trust for anonymity or use it for legitimate estate planning reasons. But you're always going to pair a trust with an LLC to kind of get rid of the disadvantages of a trust and still have the advantages of a trust. And for most people, because we're looking at setting up that LLC anyways, then we say, well, do you really need the trust, right? Is it worth the extra headache or time, energy, and legal fees to set that up, right? So hopefully that makes sense as well. So I'm going to move on to my next topic here, unless we have any questions or anything.
We don't have any questions on this.
Great. Okay. Well, it must be making perfect sense, which is awesome.
Well, it sounds like just do the LLC.
Yeah, that's exactly right? It. Yeah. Did I convince you? Is that? Yeah. So. But let's talk a little bit about liability veils more in depth. I talked about this a little bit last time and what this looks like. But when I refer to the liability veil or the LLC veil or the corporate veil, what I'm talking about is an actual kind of legal barrier between the company and you as the owner, right? And so I've put up another graphic here for those who are listening. And I have an LLC that's owned by two owners, and I have a property that's owned by the LLC. And what I have is a line between the LLC and the owners. And that's, I'm referring to that as the veil, right?
Okay.
Yeah. And so that from a very high level is just a really good visual representation of like what a liability veil actually looks like. So if a tenant slips and falls at your property, they're going to try to pierce through that LLC and pierce through the veil to get back to the owners and their personal residence, retirement account, car, right? Anything like that. So this is traditional, what I like to call traditional veil piercing, where your tenant slips and falls and they're trying to pierce through the LLC kind of in the direction where they're going from the bottom, the property, up to the owners at the top, right? But there's also reverse veil piercing. And reverse veil piercing would be where the owner, for whatever reason, commits some harm. And here I have bankruptcy. It's like the owner would declare bankruptcy, right? And then in that case, potential creditors are going to try to pierce through the other direction and go through the owner, down through the LLC, down to the property itself, right? And so here, one thing to highlight would be that that your LLC is going to be strong and it's going to have good asset protection associated with it, right? Going back to the idea of the partnership, right? The limited partners are going to have a strong liability veil and somebody's not going to be able to pierce through that. But for the general partners who have unlimited liability, there's no liability veil whatsoever. Mm. So if they have like a personal residence or retirement account, car, whatever, it's easy to get back through them to their personal assets, right? And the same goes for that sole proprietor. As I was saying, you haven't actually created a business entity or, you know, incorporated or organized. And as a result, there's really no veil associated with that whatsoever either. Right. And so how do you go about kind of increasing your asset protection and making sure that liability veil is going to be upheld? Well, again, this is a little bit of a carryover from last time, but we want to make sure that we're really good about meetings and minutes, right? At least have an annual meeting. Make sure that you're talking about, you know, big ticket items that are happening to the company and maybe even reviewing the financials from the prior year. Also keep formal minutes, right? Have somebody call the meeting to order. I like to use Robert Rules of Order kind of as a starting point. But at any rate, you know, good to talk about what's happening with the company and document it at least annually. Finally, make sure you don't commingle your bank accounts. And we had a slide last time about what that looks like.
Yeah, we talked about that for a bit.
Yeah, and so make sure that your bank accounts are clean. I don't want to pull somebody's business bank accounts and then see like trips to Safeway and whatever. You know, keep that separate. It's all about running your business in a business-like manner. If you do that, that liability veil is going to be nice and strong, right? So let's talk about larger portfolios, right? Here we were talking about kind of multiple rentals, duplexes, triplexes, you know, so you basically for those of you who have a larger portfolio rather than just like one rental, right? And here I put back up that slide where I'm talking about that master LLC with the multiple owners and the subs that are owned 100% by that master LLC. But, you know, that is a fine way to think about kind of putting your eggs in different baskets and getting your liability kind of spread out over a structure. But a lot of people ask me, like, well, at what point do I create another sub LLC, right? Or how much equity in a property is too much, or, you know, whatever. And so to me, there's kind of three different methods to kind of think about isolating liability. One would be what I call the property method, which would be just, okay, one sub LLC per property. Right. And so
regardless of size, whether it's a house or fiveplex.
Exactly. Right. And part of that thought process is, okay, you know, you may start out with just the down payment and there may not be a lot of equity there, but over time it's going to grow. And then you don't have to like restructure the LLCs or create new ones and transfer title, you know, midway through your ownership or something like that. It's just easy. One LLC per property and you're done. Right. But for clients who have a lot of properties or are really aggressive in their growth or something, they may look at it and say, well, I don't want 15 LLCs, right? And that's totally valid. I get that. And so in that case, what we might do is switch more to like an equity method. And so we say, okay, we're not going to have more than $500,000 in each LLC, or we're not going to have more than $350,000 in each LLC. And so what you do is you kind of like group some properties that don't have a lot of equity yet, right? Kind of figuring that, okay, if something happens at one of those properties and sub LLC one is sued, well, losing $350,000 and the three properties that are in there, well, that's a really hard and difficult day to swallow. But at the same time, I haven't lost the whole structure, right? Because at least I've cornered off just that amount of equity in one LLC, right? And so that's another really valid way to think about this. But another really valid way would be also to think about it in terms of the number of doors in one LLC, right? And so this might apply more to like duplexes or triplexes. But, you know, if you think about a family of four in one unit, right? If you're renting out a triplex, that might be 12 people right there who potentially could sue you, right? As opposed to a single family home with a family of four, that's only four people potentially who could sue you, right? Where something could go wrong. And so you might look at it in terms of doors and just say, well, I don't want, you know, 36 doors in one LLC while I have two doors over in this other LLC.
Right. Okay.
Right. Just because there's more people potentially where something could go wrong or they could hurt themselves. And, you know, really what you're going to do, I think, is kind of combine all three of these methods, right? It's a little artificial to break them out, but just kind of look at the portfolio in general and say, well, you know, this one particular sub LLC, am I comfortable with what's in there? You know what I mean? And again, some people look at it and just say, one property per LLC, that's fine, you know, but then you wind up with potentially a lot of properties. Now, if you set up the structure correctly, though, the master LLC is going to file the tax return for the entire structure. So you're not necessarily creating a lot of extra cost for yourself in creating a lot of extra LLCs, but you're going to have bank accounts and, you know, filings with the Secretary of State and other things that you're just going to have to kind of stay on top of, right? And it can get, I get it, it can get a little out of hand. As much as I love setting up these really large structures, right? but at any rate, there may come a point where you're looking at it and you're looking at the number of doors or the equity built up or whatever, and you just decide that it's time to duplicate these structures, right? And so here, for those listening, I have the same structure I've been harping about for two webinars, but the master LLC and the sub LLC is under that. But you might even just decide that you're going to create that exact same structure again. And that's even better for asset protection because you have more separation there, right? Like somebody couldn't, it'd be very difficult for somebody to jump from a property and one structure like over to the other structure. So this is probably a little bit stronger, but it does come at the cost of an extra tax return, right? And so here where we have, what is this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 companies, we're filing two tax returns rather than just the one, right? So, yeah. Any questions or anything? Or any?
I've got a question back on that previous slide. So yeah. Is there kind of set up this these two parallel structures? We've got Master LLC 1 plus your respective sub LLCs and like Master LLC 2. Is there a tipping point? Because just like you talked about in the sub LLCs a few slides ago, putting, you know, a certain number of doors or equity in that sub LLC to limit liability to that. I'm assuming having double master LLCs just really, really extra, you know, very much limits your liability. Is there like a rule of thumb that, hey, great, once I get to such and such a point in my rental portfolio investing, I should then have separate master LLCs with sub properties? Like, what would be the tipping point for this?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I really don't have a ready answer for that. And the reason is because it really just comes back to two things. And number one, your risk tolerance is kind of the first thing. And the second is your willingness to go through headache and hassle. We've talked a lot about headache and hassle with like S corporations, right? And like, yeah, you may generate some tax benefits. And in this case, you may generate stronger asset protection, but you have two tax returns, right? And so there's just more headache and hassle associated with running that. And so for some clients, that's worth it, right? They look at it and they may have, you know, whatever it may be, $1 million in the first structure, the master LLC structure on the left. And then they're considering adding three more rentals. So they just look at it and say, you know, just to get the extra asset protection out of this, it's worth the extra tax return and hassle because I want to protect the $1 million that I have over in this other structure or try to get myself some more, you know, kind of separation within my portfolio. And that's totally valid, right? But at the same time, some people may look at this and say, it's not worth it. Just lump them all together back to the same master LLC and I'll just file the one tax return. And that's just because their risk tolerance and their willingness to go through the headache and hassle of all of that is just, you know, it's just different, right? So both are valid, but it's going to come back and be driven by you and you know, not so much like a legal rule of thumb or kind of like an industry standard.
So I got a question here. Would the structure change with properties that are larger than a 4-unit building? So getting into like, you know, 5-unit plus buildings?
Yeah.
Does that structure change?
It's a really good question. And I mean, I guess my two thought processes there is number one, like once you start getting into the bigger properties, is it possible that you're going to get like self-employment tax because you're managing it or something, right? Now, if you have a property manager or something like that, you don't have to worry about that at all. And in this case, you're really looking at this structure. But what I'm really asking there is almost like a tax planning question, like is the partnership tax return going to be the best treatment for you? Or might it make sense to look at an S corporation? And in that case, we're absolutely going to run it in its own structure because that S corporation tax treatment is going to require a totally different LLC and a totally different approach, right? But let's just assume that it's totally passive, right? That you have a property manager, you're just getting the passive rent on it. In that case, it really, once again, just comes exactly back to your risk tolerance, right? Some people may look at like the door method, for instance, and just say, you know, 5 doors in one sub LLC is really driving me crazy. You know, like that's just too many people potentially who can, you know, hurt themselves. If they're able to cut through my structure, then they're going to get at the equity in these other properties. And that makes me really nervous. And so what we do in that case is just set up an LLC specifically for that larger property. Right. And in that case, it probably would just be a master LLC all by itself with no sub. Right. But yeah, it's really going to be driven by those considerations and kind of when your tipping point is. Some people might look at a fiveplex. It's just so customized. Some people might look at a fiveplex and say, I'm fine putting that in the same structure as my single family homes. But then they get to six and they say, oh, no, that's too many. You know, and so it's just different for really everybody.
So here's another question. That's if my leases are already in my own name and I transfer my properties to an LLC, is that enough to protect me, or do I need to re-sign all the leases in the LLC name outside my personal name? Yeah. That's an interesting question I thought of before.
Yeah. I mean, I would absolutely get the leases assigned over to the LLCs. And the reason is because I want the tenants to know that they're going to sue an LLC and they're not going to sue you personally, right? They're by and large, they're not savvy enough to go look at the clerk and recorder records, you know, to figure out who owns the property and is it going to roll back to an LLC. I think psychologically, it's worth kind of playing that game and saying, no, you know, it's in a company, it's in this limited entity, just to set the framework kind of early on, or kind of the thought process early on, that they're dealing with a company and not you personally. That's valuable there. But second, it goes back to your formalities again, right? And I was talking about how your formalities are really important for whether your asset protection is going to be upheld. Well, you know, if your leases are in your personal name, but the property is actually in the business, there's a question there about, well, why was it drafted that way, right? And it may be a timing issue, which sounds like maybe the call of the question here is more of a timing thing. But what I would do is just assign the leases to the rental to the companies, right? That's a purely internal document that the tenant's not going to be involved with really at all. And then just provide like a formal notification to the tenant that just says, hey, the lease has been assigned to this company from now on, address all, you know, correspondence to this business at this address and whatever. Right. I think taking that extra step just goes back to your formalities. And really, if you kind of scroll back and think about it kind of from a high level, it makes sense, right? It makes sense that the owner of the property would actually have the lease.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, really, really good question.
So that's all the questions on this round.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. So let's talk about where, right? A lot of people, this is one of the most common questions that I get asked is like, well, where are we actually going to get, where are we actually going to organize? And doesn't, you know, Wyoming or Nevada or Delaware, right? Don't they have good laws and isn't it better to be out with them?
All my credit cards come from Delaware.
Is that right? Yeah, is that right?
I've never noticed all everything from banks are they're all Delaware.
Yeah, yeah. Delaware historically has been like the biggest haven for corporations, right? And it's really funny because then Nevada and Wyoming really started to go after LLCs to be like the Delaware of LLCs, right? So really interesting. But you know, there actually is some validity to where you might go. This is called forum shopping, because basically what you're doing is you're shopping for the better law. You're shopping for where the places are maybe more friendly towards business owners and giving you the benefit of better law. But this is once again a case of maybe getting sold on this idea, and you know, there's just not. When you really get down into the details and flesh it out, it doesn't actually make sense. And the reason I say that is because basically, I'm going to start with choice of law. There's a concept where in the law called choice of law, which is basically the judge deciding what law they're going to apply. Right. And so if you are in, say, Wyoming and you get sued and your property's in Colorado, the harm happened in Colorado, you're in Colorado, the tenant's in Colorado, the judge basically asks the question, well, why am I applying Wyoming law when everything happened down in Colorado? Right. And so you have to overcome these arguments and prove that there's some compelling reason to apply Wyoming law. And I think when you go through that analysis, you'll actually find that most of the time they don't apply the quote unquote better law. So if you want to benefit from Wyoming's better law, and there's no doubt that it is better because it has charging order protection and other things, you have to buy your property in Wyoming, right?
But like, there's a problem with that. You're buying in Wyoming then.
Right. Yeah. As opposed to Colorado. Right. And so I'm not advocating that. Right. Because I think that's ridiculous to, it's funny because a lot of times people want to like save so much money in tax that they like totally reinvent their life to like take advantage of all of these tax benefits. And I a lot of times I just have to say, back up and look at the big picture here. Like, you know, like what actually are you accomplishing or what's your goal here? And it's like, if you want rental properties and you're here in Colorado, just buy rental properties in Colorado and incorporate or organize in Colorado, right? Don't try to do this. But at any rate, you know, the question is like, where are you conducting business? So let's say that you went ahead and organized up in Wyoming, and then you start renting property down here in Colorado. Well, you're going to have to register with both states. You have to register in Colorado as well as Wyoming. And so now you're paying two Secretary of State filing fees every single year. You have to file potentially an out-of-state tax return. Now, every state's different, and some of them don't require tax returns. But all the same, you have to look at tax compliance in both states. And overall, it's just adding more time, energy, and hassle just to do this. The biggest one that I think is really just egregious is Nevada. A lot of people get sold on this idea that they're going to organize in Nevada, they're going to have rentals in Colorado. Well, the annual fee with Colorado is $10, not a big deal. But out in Nevada, you have like a $200 filing fee with the Secretary of State, and then a $300 list of your officers. And so year over year, you're paying $500 just for the benefit of being out in Nevada, but you're not even guaranteed the protection of the quote unquote better law out there in Nevada, right? And so the take home idea here is just like, you know, there's some validity to forum shopping, right? But if you're doing business in Colorado, Colorado law most likely is going to apply. You're not going to benefit from being out of state, and just incorporate or organize with Colorado, pay the $10 Secretary of State and dance up and down, you know, do a little happy jig that it's $10 and not $500 and just move on. Right. So hopefully that also makes sense there.
So we had a question come in right as we were exiting out of the that last master LLC comparison with multiple ones. So question is, if I have a property in, you know, LLC number one that's not held or owned by a master LLC, but it's owned by me as an individual, and then I sell the property owned by LLC and 1031 it into another property, can that LLC be rolled under a master LLC?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And that is that, I don't know if that's better for you or for a 1031 QI?
It would be worth talking to a 1031 QI because they probably have a perspective for sure. You know, for me, it's funny because the 1031s, I actually looked at this issue now that I'm thinking about it. I looked at it, I think it might have been a year ago for one of my clients or a year and a half ago. And ultimately, I did tell them to talk to the QI, the qualified intermediary, and that's the person who's going to help you with that 1031 or kind of help you identify your replacement property and make sure they have an eye to the deadlines and everything else. But at any rate, I think I ultimately told him to talk to his QI because they probably had a perspective. And I think they may have advised him to go ahead with the transfer. But that was actually against my recommendation. Here's my thought process. There's a tacking period at the beginning of a 1031 and at an end of a 1031 where the owner has to be the same, right? And so basically to take advantage of a 1031, the owner at the beginning of the process has to be the same as the owner at the end of the process. And then they tack a bunch of time onto the end of the process and also at the beginning of the process. As far as I can tell, in tax court cases, in the Treasury regulations, in the tax code, there's no like time limit or anything that like they look at this for it. But the tax community as a whole has kind of landed on 2 years, right? And so it's kind of like the owner has to be an owner for 2 years, then you can 1031, and then the owner has to stay the owner for 2 years on the back end, then you can switch the owner, right? So the QI ended up approving this, or I think said that they kind of gave their blessing to this. And the reason is because if you transfer the sub LLC from you personally over to the master LLC, the EIN, the employer identification number of the sub LLC doesn't change. And so the IRS more than likely is not going to be wise to this transfer because it's all reported under that EIN, right? And so that's technically maybe true. But if you go back to kind of the underlying like law and regulations and everything kind of surrounding this, it kind of flies in the face of that because the owner after the transfer is not going to be the same for that 2-year period. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I've talked to one QI about this, just, not quite this question, but very similar. And I can't remember the answer. But I think they had different timelines than you, which is kind of the interesting thing where a lot of times is because, and from my understanding of, the 1031 section of the tax code, there's not a whole lot of clear cut stuff. And so it sounds like different QIs have different opinions and different ways they read the stuff is the way I've seen the chips falls. I've talked to different people and done my deep research on Google over the years.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And to be fair, especially when it comes to like 1031s or anything with retirement plans or, whatever, I'm going to give a very conservative reading to this.
Yep.
Right. Because I really don't want to lead my client up a path. Number one, liability reasons. But number two, I care about my clients as people. I don't want to lead them up a path. Right. I get worried sometimes, maybe not so much with the 1031 QIs, but in like the retirement plan context, or sometimes I can tell that somebody's really just trying to close the deal, right? And kind of like get their commission or get, whatever it may be. And sometimes my conservative reading is different just because the motivations are a little bit different. Do you know what I mean? And I don't know, the 1031s, I'm not accusing them of anything, right? The QIs, I think, generally do a good job, but the time frames are really difficult just because, I think it really is just kind of a general consensus in the tax community that's like, okay, 2 years is what you're looking for. But I've looked for that hardly like over and above like any actual thing I can point to, any actual authority that I can point to and say, 2 years really is that point. And I can't find it. I don't know where it is. So...
So, great question, but definitely reach out to 1031 QI. If you need one, email me. I can definitely connect you. But his main focus is protecting liability, where 1031s are focused on more on helping you defer your capital gains on selling property. So you got different people, both experts coming from slightly different angles as well. So keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's true.
And they're both things you want to consider because they both have, potentially huge consequences.
Yeah. Yeah, they should go hand in hand, really. So at any rate, just to recap really quick, choice of entity, LLC by and large is going to be the way that you're going to go. Next time I'm going to talk about corporations and maybe why you'd choose one of those or disadvantages, advantages there. Liability veils, best practices, run your company well, cleanly, and with an eye to formality, right? If you do that, you're going to have a great liability veil, but also choose the right entity, right? If you're going to be a general partner in a general partnership or a general partner in a limited partnership, man, you're going to have problems, right? Same with a sole proprietorship. So choose your entity well, and then after you do that, just maintain your formalities, right? Larger portfolios, think about your risk tolerance and decide where it makes sense to split things off or get more, division within your structure. Maybe even think about starting fresh, right? And getting another tax return involved, disadvantage, but greater asset protection advantage associated with that. And finally, where, forum shopping is a valid concept, but you kind of have to then follow that forum and then buy your rental properties or whatever in that forum. So if you're here in Colorado, just incorporate or organize here in Colorado. There are still ways to maintain anonymity, to be safe, to be smart, to structure correctly, even here in Colorado, and the $10 Secretary of State fee year over year is really hard to beat. So, I have to give Colorado the easy plug there. So with that, feel free to reach out to me, to Chris, with anything. And Chris, thank you very much for having me here today.
Of course. This is, like I said, I enjoy doing this because I always learn something. And then they're a great resource for my clients, also a great resource for a lot of other people just around the real estate investing community. All right, everyone. So I think we answered all the questions here. We had some really good ones come in. So if you got any more, save those for the third one. the third episode. And make sure you come in and check out the third episode as well, because that's going to be the last and final episode in this three-part series. So thank you for watching or listening this. And Peter, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you all.